The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
First off, I want to say how grateful we should be that we have you at Relevant Radio along with Father Rocky and all the other people that are on the radio. You do so much for us.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Lots of great topics on tap today, so I know you're going to want to jump in and join the conversations. We're going to be talking about the eviction moratorium, the legalities, the financial impacts. We'll be talking a little bit about the Conscience Project and the electric vehicle executive order. We'll be talking about economics with our good friend Peter Grandage. We'll also talk a little bit about vaccine passports and what that means and what the implications of that are. We're going to have a great show, so be sure to stick around for the whole thing. Joining me right now is Michael New, associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and a research associate at the Bush School at the Catholic University of America. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael_J_New, and we're going to be talking today about comparing American abortion law with European abortion law, which is the more radical, as well as taking a look at some other data in regards to abortions last year. So we'll be talking about that. We'll also be talking a little bit about the issue at the University of Pittsburgh, where there's some taxpayer money that's gone to a fetal tissue bank at the University of Pittsburgh. It's become controversial. There's some issues about that. We're talking about all of that with Michael New, and he's on the line with us now. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Always enjoy talking with you, Michael. It's always great to have you when I'm on the air here at Relevant Radio. And we've got three good topics here. We're going to try to squeeze this into a half an hour. So I know at the Charlotte Lozier Institute, let's start with the comparison between European and American abortion law, because the Charlotte Lozier Institute just did this. Angela Nguyen did this paper, just came out about, I'd say, a little over a week ago. This is coming up as the Supreme Court is going to review the new Mississippi abortion law that restricts abortions to 15 weeks. That's called the Dobbs case. They're going to take it back up when they meet again, so it won't be until probably next year that we'll find out what they're going to do with this. But there's been a lot of people talking about how this is sort of a radical rewriting of, or an attempt to radically rewrite abortion law here in the United States. But I think, Michael, this is a pretty good reminder that American abortion law is, in comparison to the rest of the West, rather radical already.
Right, certainly. This is a very good study that it shows that abortion policy in the U.S., even if this Mississippi law is upheld and we're able to protect preborn children after 15 weeks gestation, our abortion policy would still be more permissive than abortion policy in a vast majority of European countries. That's interesting. I mean, Europe is more secular than the U.S. Europeans typically don't go to church as often on a whole range of issues. Policy in Europe is thought to be more progressive, more liberal than the U.S. But when it comes to abortion, they actually have laws in Europe that are more protective than the laws we have in the U.S. And this Lozier study compared abortion policy in 50 European countries, and it found that in 8 of these countries, they don't have abortion on demand, that if a woman wants an abortion, she has to come up with a reason for it. It's not just abortion on demand like in the U.S. And in 39 countries, there's a gestational age limit that's more protective what we have in the U.S. and was more protective than what's being litigated in the Mississippi case. So only really 3 European countries have abortion laws or abortion policies that are more permissive than the Mississippi law. Those would be Iceland, Netherlands, and Sweden. So the rest of Europe has, you know, laws that are much more protective than what's being litigated right now in front of the Supreme Court this coming fall.
And Angelina Nguyen also concluded no European country allows elective abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, as is permitted in the United States. And so, I mean, this is, it's interesting, too, because this, the European continent is a place where they're way far out in front in terms of things like euthanasia, assisted suicide. You know, and we're certainly very concerned about where that's going here as well. But I mean, they're way far out on that. But it's I was surprised when I was reading this. I kind of sort of knew some of this, but I am surprised that that abortion has been limited as much as it has been in Europe. I find that very surprising.
Right. And I mean, I think you know, the difference, obviously, is that in the United States, our abortion policy didn't, by and large, come through the democratic process.
Right.
It came by the Supreme Court, you know, making a completely horrendous decision in Roe v. Wade that had, you know, no basis whatsoever in the history or the structure or the text of the Constitution. Whereas in Europe, more, not necessarily in every country, but many countries, you know, their abortion policy is a result of a democratic process. And, you know, even in a more, quote unquote, liberal, secular parts of the country, like Europe, they're not comfortable, you know, with late-term abortion. So I think in the study, the most country with the most permissive policy is the Netherlands. Even in the Netherlands, they limit abortions to 24 weeks gestation. So by and large, you know, all of Europe is, you know, far more protective of unborn children than we are here in the U.S.
Now, bear in mind, of course, that obviously Michael and I and everybody else here is hoping that we're going to eventually put an end to abortion for any human life, regardless of the status of gestation. But if we were able to draw some limits on this, we would be saving at least some lives. And that is, I guess I'm curious, in your opinion, why has Europe been, I just use the word conservative just as a, you know, as a relative term. Why have they been more conservative about this than Americans? Is it just strictly because it's gone through the democratic process and voters there just simply aren't that radical, or is that still a sort of a remnant of the Christian heritage underpinning much of Europe's you know, social construct?
You know, I think it's a variety of things. You know, I think that, you know, a lot of the parties in Europe, you know, do have kind of a Christian heritage to them. You know, that I think that is part of it. I think that, you know, in, you know, Europe, again, I think the democratic process has had a lot to do with it. Again, I think that, you know, in most of the Western world, there's just not great support for, you know, frankly, third trimester abortions. You know, I think that they agree that, you know, if abortion should be legal, there should be some, you know, legal limits on it. And it's not the flashpoint in Europe that it really is in the U.S. Obviously, there's people in Europe who are pro-life and people in Europe who support abortion. But I don't get the sense there's a big push in these countries to make their abortion laws even more permissive. So, you know, I think, again, the democratic process, you know, arrived at conclusions. They're not the conclusions that I would have or you would have. Right. But again, even in, you know, secular countries, there's just a belief that, you know, second, third trimester abortions are problematic, and if not discouraged, should just be illegal.
Well, it's interesting because you often will hear people say, well, courts here should be able to take into account the way that courts rule in Europe. There should be, you know, should be open to that sort of thing. Every once in a while, you'll see a judge reference that, and it becomes very controversial in legal circles as to why they would do that, when it really should be sticking to American law. But in this case, I think we might see people say, "Hey, well, look, you know, this might be a good way to approach this." I don't think you'll actually see that in any of the principles filings in Dobbs. There might be some amicus briefs that make mention of this, but I think the principles will probably stick to the law as is. We're speaking with Michael New of the Charlotte Lozier Institute, as well as a contributor at National Review's The Corner, nationalreview.com. And let's turn to that, Michael, because you have a piece up that was on Wednesday, talking about the data on abortions from 2020. And I think that we can take a little heart in this. Even though the abortion rate increased somewhat, it's not as bad as people thought it might be, given the pandemic's impact.
Right, that some states have been releasing abortion data from 2020. Within the past month or so, at least five states have given us some new data: Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Minnesota, and Texas. And the good news is that it doesn't appear that in 2020 there was some kind of COVID abortion surge. Where there is a lot of anecdotal evidence out there suggesting that abortion numbers might be increasing. There were news reports from abortion facilities that women who made appointments were more likely to show up and obtain abortions. There were also some anecdotal reports that abortion funds that tragically subsidize abortions through private donations were seeing an increase in calls. But we have hard data. And the good news is there was no abortion surge. The bad news is that abortion numbers, sadly, are increasing gradually. Four of the five states that provided us with some data saw their abortion numbers going up. Texas was the only state to see their abortion numbers fall, but there's a bit of a caveat there.
Right.
Governor Abbott, in late March, issued an executive order that halted non-essential surgical procedures. That had the effect of preventing a lot of abortions in March and April. If you throw kind of March and April out of that data set, you see the numbers in Texas rise a little bit. So, there's no big abortion surge, but numbers are going up slowly, and I think pro-lifers need to be aware of that.
We're talking with Michael New and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And I remember when that happened, there was a court fight over that as well. The various states had begun shutting down elective surgeries and non-emergency surgeries as a way to preserve PPE, the protective equipment that the personal protective equipment is what PPE stands for, like masks, gowns, gloves, and that sort of thing, because we had a severe shortage of that at the beginning of the pandemic, and they wanted to make sure that those resources were reserved for treating COVID rather than dealing with non-emergency and elective surgeries, which makes a lot of sense. However, some people felt that abortion didn't fall under that. Governor Abbott disagreed, and they took him to court over that. And I think that, if I remember correctly, and Michael, you'll probably remember this better than I do, I think that Abbott lost that battle in court eventually. And either that or they just relented and lifted the bar on elective surgeries. But as I recall, that did go to court.
It did go to court, and I think the executive order just expired at a certain point, and abortions in Texas were able to continue, tragically.
Yes.
The one thing about this data that's interesting and concerning is that we do see a real increase in chemical abortions, and that's something that pro-lifers really need to be aware of, that
right.
In the three states that really gave us some data on chemical abortions, we see an increase in chemical abortions by more than 23% in each of these three states since 2017. Texas has seen their chemical abortion numbers go up by more than 70% since 2017. So we see from national and state data, chemical abortions are becoming more and more prevalent. Pro-lifers really need to be aware of this. There's good research showing that chemical abortions have a much higher complication rate. Some studies have seen a complication rate that's four times higher than surgical abortions. You also have a situation where women who obtain these chemical abortions do encounter the remains of their unborn child. That can be psychologically traumatizing. So again, this increase in chemical abortions is one we frankly need to be aware of. We need to do more educational efforts, and we need to really push back that this is something that's concerning.
And it's concerning. It's part of this sort of industrialization of abortion that's been going on for decades, but it sort of raises this to another level. And speaking of which, our final topic, and this one we're going to have to dig into here just a little bit with Michael New from the Charlotte Lozier Institute, is the issue of the $2.7 million federal grant money that was given to the University of Pittsburgh to boost the harvesting of fetal tissue for research. And there's two things that go with this. First off is just the fact that they're doing this, but the second thing is that the University of Pittsburgh focused on minorities. I guess you could say targeted minorities, but they've really focused on minorities in terms of those the tissues. If 50% of the tissue had to come from minority abortions, 25% had to come from black women. These types of things normally fly under the radar, but given all of the issues over the last few years, first highlighted by the way by David DeLeiden, about the industrialization of fetal tissue as a product of abortion. I mean, this is kind of disturbing.
It's very disturbing. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just awful. I mean, there's so many ways this story is disturbing. I almost don't know where to begin.
Yes.
First off, the fact that this is even happening in the first place. Secondly, the fact that not only is it happening, but your tax dollars and my tax dollars are paying for it. This is a $2.7 million grant for the National Institute of Health that's funding this research. And they're harvesting, you know, fetal kidneys, fetal bladders, and other organs. And you're also right that not only are they doing this, but they're also targeting minorities, that basically half the organs are from unborn children who are non-white, and one quarter are from those who are black. Again, that, you know, this contract basically says that they will try to procure fetal organs from, you know, five unborn babies every week, ranging in gestation from 6 to 42 weeks. So, yeah, this is just awful on just so many levels. I do want to give Judicial Watch and the Center for Medical Progress a lot of credit for researching, investigating this, filing a Freedom of Information Act request to get this information. This is just a horrific practice. It needs to stop.
Right. By the way, two really good resources. Also, I've got it up from the Washington Free Beacon, which is highlighted it yesterday. So this story can be found. I want to get back to this, but let's go to the phones really quickly. Andrew in Madison, Wisconsin has a question about our previous topic. Andrew, welcome to the conversation.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to the data about abortions rising or falling, and I was wondering if that would include the legalization of abortifacients that we mailed out, if the data would include those numbers for the pills being sent out, because those wouldn't really be on the books for appointment.
It's a great question, Andrew. And from the conversation that we were having, I think that those numbers did include mailed out abortifacients, right, in 2020, or will that be reported separately?
That's an excellent question, and I think that we need to pay close attention to that. I don't have a accurate answer. I do think if it was a facility that was, you know, mailing out abortion pills, I think it, you know, would be included. Though perhaps it was like an overseas facility or an unlicensed or unregistered facility, it may not be. So, you know, that's one thing we're concerned about, is that women obtaining chemical abortion pills from overseas or from just places that aren't properly, you know, registered. I think that it's awful that women would have a chemical abortion without medical supervision. I think that's extremely unhealthy. It's fatal to the unborn child, but could certainly be damaging to the women's health as well. That if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy and she obtains a chemical abortion, that could be fatal. So, you know, I think that those done by mail order are probably included in these numbers, but I'm not entirely certain. But that's an excellent question.
Great question, Andrew. Thank you so much for calling. We're talking with Michael New of the Charlotte Lozier Institute and contributor to National Review, and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Getting back to this issue about the tissue bank, the more you read into this, the more disturbing it gets. Apparently what the University of Pittsburgh was looking for was tissue from abortions that were induced labor abortions. That was what they were preferring,
right,
in this. And I'm just going to read this. I'm just going to read this off here. It says the University of Pittsburgh said fetuses should have minimized warm ischemic time, a medical term to describe the time that an organ is without blood flow. It also lists labor induction as a utilized abortion procedure to obtain the organs. And that has the implication, as the vice president of the Charlotte Lozier Institute told the Free Beacon, that some of these babies were born alive and then their organs and tissues are removed. That would be the, if you were looking to fulfill that particular protocol, that would be the method that you would use that would best fit that. And it's not clear. It won't ever be clear how many of those abortions fit that that potential scenario.
Right. I mean, we don't know for certain that, you know, children are being born alive and having, you know, their organs harvested. I mean, we don't know
right.
that for certain. But this raises a lot of very important questions. I mean, Pitt is very clear in this grant application that they're trying to keep these organs at body temperature for as long as possible. And that means, you know, harvesting these organs, frankly, right away. Does that necessarily mean that, you know, the organs are being harvested after the children are born alive? We don't know that. We don't know that for certain. But it does raise some interesting questions that I think merit further investigation.
I also have to point out that the University of Pittsburgh has responded to this. I mean, they're responding to these inquiries, so they're not exactly circling the wagons. Their response to the issue of the oversampling of minorities in these issues is twofold. First off, they are saying that they're required to be diverse based on National Institute of Health, guidelines or protocols. The other is that they're researching kidney disease, which disproportionately impacts minorities. Now, I'm not necessarily sure that that's the case, but both of those sound like very odd explanations for this disparity that we're seeing in the sample data here.
Right. I mean, those explanations are not, my opinion, compelling in the slightest. I mean, the thing, this is just plain, pure, and simple, a really unethical practice. And the fact that, they're frankly targeting minorities makes it even worse. I mean, I guarantee that, these are, important things to research, but there are ethical ways to go about this kind of research. I mean, there are adult stem cells out there which are actually saving lives today and leading to cures today that these researchers could use. Most scientists agree that adult stem cells are really a good source of information and a good source resource for scientists who are in these interested in these issues. So again, I just think it's an unethical practice, and Pitt's efforts to try to put a favorable spin on it, frankly, are just kind of laughable in my opinion.
Well, Michael, I mean, it's not as though there aren't other sources of this. You have umbilical stem cells, which if you want to get a neonatal stem cell, there's stem cells in umbilical tissue that could be used. But the pursuit of adult stem cells has actually resulted in several therapeutic developments, whereas I'm not sure that there's really been a embryonic stem cell research project that has resulted in a successful therapy. Are you aware of any of
of any. I mean, there was a big debate over in the Bush administration about funding for embryonic stem cell research, and a lot of pro-lifers are being accused of being anti-science. But if you look at it, adult stem cells have a great track record of success. I'm really unaware of any treatment that embryonic stem cells have been useful in treating. So I think that and you also look at where private foundations are putting their money. Most private foundations with an interest in this kind of research are funding adult stem cell research. I just think that, the work on embryonic stem cells does not have a track record of success, and obviously, and then you obviously the ethical implications that are important. We shouldn't be doing research on aborted children. I think that's just an important rule to have in mind. So again, I think that it's clearly an ethical tapping at Pitt. I'm glad that Center for Medical Progress filed this Freedom of Information Act. This needs more exposure, and it needs to end.
Michael New, thank you so much. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Congress punted on the eviction moratorium and created a firestorm of debate over this. The White House initially said that it didn't have the authority to extend or reimpose an eviction moratorium based on the written opinion that allowed the first moratorium to continue to its prior expiration date. The Biden administration reversed themselves on this and then decided to go ahead and impose a new moratorium with slightly different parameters. And now everyone's confused. And we have a lot of people who have, competing equities, if you want to put it that way, in the mix here. And this has a potential to damage renters, landlords, and the economy overall if it's not handled properly. Here to help untangle all of this, and untangling is what it needs, is Steve Simpson. He's a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, where he heads up their separation of powers practice group. Before that, he was at the Institute for Justice, where he litigated free speech, campaign finance, and economic liberty cases, including Swedenborg v. Kelly, the Institute's successful Supreme Court challenge to New York's ban on the interstate shipping of wine. You can find Pacific Legal Foundation at pacificlegal.org. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, look, I mean, we were talking about this last week. I was on the air while they were trying to do some last minute maneuvering to get Congress to extend the, to actually pass something in statute, which is what the Supreme Court, or at least Brett Kavanaugh, said needed to happen. At the time, we were talking about this, saying, look, there are a lot of people here who are dealing with a massive government intervention, and there really should be some sort of rational off-ramp to that, and it's really on Congress to provide that. And not surprisingly, Congress never didn't act. They got started on this way too late. And now we've got a mess. And now you've got the CDC issuing another moratorium, despite the fact that the Supreme Court indicated that they didn't have the constitutional authority to issue it in the first place. And this was a narrowly decided thing. The stay was narrowly kept in place, not vacated. But Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote the only opinion on this, which stated that there wasn't that they didn't have the authority for the stay in the first place. But since it was expiring within 32 days, they just didn't want to act on it. They were just going to let it expire, and Congress needed to act on this. So I've got a number of questions. The first of which is, what is the actual legal impact of the opinion related to the order that was issued by the Supreme Court on June 29th? Is that really a governing opinion?
Well, I mean, there's a really good argument that it is, under the principle that, you know, the narrowest grounds on which you can find five justices that have agreed typically is the ruling of the court. Whether that applies in the narrow context of a stay is a kind of open question. But as a practical matter, I think everybody recognizes, and you mentioned before that the Biden administration, in fact, Biden himself recognized this, that there are five justices on the Supreme Court who believe that the CDC eviction moratorium is unlawful. Now, Biden has stated that it was unconstitutional. That's not technically true. I mean, I do think it's unconstitutional. But the more direct point is, and a number of courts have held this, not just, so this isn't just a question of what the Supreme Court did in this D.C. Circuit case, or this D.C. case in this stay, but the Sixth Circuit now has struck down the eviction moratorium. A couple cases, or a case that we've litigated, right, in Northern District of Ohio, same thing. A court in Texas did, the D.C. District Court did. So the weight of opinion as it currently stands is against the moratorium. And the basic grounds that the courts have all agreed on is, look, the CDC just doesn't have the statutory authority to do this. I can talk more about what the statute says, but bottom line is Congress did not authorize the CDC to make a sweeping change to one's right to go into court all across the country in literally every state. When it passed a law called the Public Health Services Act in 1946, which allows, in essence, the CDC to prevent the transmission of disease directly across state lines through the kinds of things of, I always think of it as, you know, they can disinfect a rail car, they can do inspections, things like that. The kind of thing you might think that the CDC could do. This is a pretty narrow statute, and the CDC has, since last September, interpreted it enormously broadly. Way beyond, I think, what can rationally, the statute can rationally allow. And that's what the courts have now, I think the weight of opinion has said, look, this is way beyond what Congress said the CDC can do. As you pointed out, Congress should have, if they wanted an eviction moratorium, they should have gotten together and passed one. They did it in the CARES Act. And I mean, Brett Kavanaugh, I think, pointed that out. They couldn't get it together. They couldn't do it. And so the moratorium should have ended then. I mean, this is a rule of law society with the principle of separation of powers. And that means Congress makes the law, not administrative agencies, not the Biden administration or any administration. And that's absolutely fundamental to what constitutional government is all about. So it should have stopped there. And I really think this is both blatantly political And it's just an outrageous, raw kind of exercise of power.
We're going to get into some more exercises of power, I think, a little bit later in the show when we talk about vaccine mandates with another one of our guests today. But let's stick with this for right now. I wanted to point that out. I'm glad that you brought this up, which is that Congress actually did act to do exactly what's going on, what they want to the CDC to do right now. In the original CARES Act, which was passed, I think, in late April, it was the second emergency bill. There was a initial emergency bill, which was much smaller in scale. It was an emergency bill of an emergency bill. I mean, they just got together and did something really quickly until they could put something larger together. The CARES Act was the larger second bill, and that was passed in late April of 2020. Actually did include an eviction moratorium. Now, that ran out. I don't recall exactly when that ran out, but after that is when the CDC started saying, well, we have the authority to extend that. And this is the problem, that the CDC's jurisdiction doesn't really cover housing, rents, landlords. That's not part of their jurisdiction. And as you say, the 1946 law, and I can never remember exactly what it's called, is really
Public Health Services Act. Sorry.
Public Health. You're right, Steve. The Public Health Services Act. And I'm going to try to remember that. For some reason, I have this mental block on this particular title, was not meant for that purpose and never did envision the type of scope of authority, which is really almost like a wartime scope of authority over the entire economy. I mean, that's really what the CDC is envisioning when they intervene in this manner. And because Congress did it, it really should be Congress. Congress is the one to go back and do it again. I mean, Congress is responsible to voters or accountable to voters. We can argue whether or not Congress has a constitutional authority to do this as well, especially because it doesn't necessarily, in fact, it almost never is going to impact impact interstate commerce. Whether they have the authority to do this on anything else other than HUD housing. But at the very least, nobody was challenging Congress's authority to do this, whereas these landlords associations, very clearly, and I think very correctly challenged the CDC on their actions.
Oh, absolutely. And as you say, we can debate about whether Congress has this authority. I think we probably agree that Congress has much narrower authority than Congress has exercised over the last sort of half century or so.
Right.
I should point out, I'm not a fan of an eviction moratorium, no matter where it comes from, for a lot of reasons, for policy kinds of reasons. And I think it trenches on property rights. But the bottom line is, look, if we're going to have this, it has to come from Congress, because that's the branch of government that actually represents the people. And that if you want to ensure that our government is accountable to the people and that the laws are actually being debated and that they are, they are based on a kind of broad-based consensus and that you actually have elected representatives taking responsibility for those laws, good or bad, they should take the hit for this. People should be able to vote their representatives out of office or vote them into office, depending on what their view of an eviction moratorium is. And not for nothing, that includes landlords. I mean, one of the really horrible things about this moratorium is that it forces landlords to shoulder a giant burden of the pandemic. Now, if our view is this is a public health issue, then it should be a cost that is borne by the public, which that means me and you and everybody else who's a citizen of this country.
Right.
And if we don't want to pay our tax dollars to bail out renters, so to speak, or to keep people housed, then, we shouldn't expect landlords to do any more than if an agency passed a law forcing all grocery stores to stay open or all, grocery store workers to work for free or, I mean, anything like that, it would be outrageous. You can't impose burdens like that on a small segment of society, which is exactly why we have an accountable Congress that can be voted out of office when they do things like that. If it's done by the Centers for Disease Control, you don't have that check. In fact, there's really no political check on them. This is one of the big problems with our administrative state. We've concentrated so much power in a handful of bureaucrats in D.C. and in this case, Atlanta, and they're not accountable to the people. And I mean, that is just the definition of unconstitutional government. It's a big problem and it's got to stop.
We are speaking with Steve Simpson, senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org, and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You know, and there was money in there that was supposed to be going to the landlords to help, you know, buffer the pain of this eviction moratorium, and Congress has been pointing the finger at governors who have been giving $49 billion, I believe it was, in the various relief packages. I mean, CARES was the first significant relief package. There were some minor momentary relief in that first one in March of 2020. We've had two others since then. So there's a lot of money that we've printed off for the purposes of buffering these issues, for instance. And it wasn't just that. We did the Paycheck Protection Program to buffer the effects of the shutdowns, the government shutdowns of commerce, so that we could help out small businesses, keep them from closing their doors, keep their employees on payroll, that sort of thing. There was a number of these types of, there was some in there for the airlines. I believe there was one in there for Amtrak as well, bailout money for that, while they weren't able to get any income coming in. So we have done those things, right? That was in there. However, Congress didn't do a very good job of setting this up so that it was efficiently getting to the people to whom it needed to get. And with the expiration of this moratorium, and now with the reimposition of it, they've introduced so much uncertainty that nobody is quite sure how to go forward on this, least of all the renters and the landlords. I mean, we can argue the politics of this, but at the end, I know that you agree with this as well. In the end, the people who are going to be hurting the most by this are the landlords and the renters, and we could end up destroying that whole rental market economy, because the people who have invested, you know, their life savings in one other property so that they can draw some continuous income from it, and who have mortgages, who are now behind on mortgages, having to work 2-3 jobs to keep up with 2 different mortgages on 2 different properties, those people are going to lose their shirts, and that housing will not be available for people who actually need it down the road.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a cascading effect anytime I think government takes an action like this, and it's an example of sort of kicking the can down the road. So they say, well, we don't want anybody to be evicted because that may contribute to the spread of disease. Well, okay, I mean, there's something to that. It's a non-crazy perspective. But recognize that when you do that, two things happen. One is you put a huge burden on landlords who themselves now can't pay their employees, not for nothing. Landlords employ people, right? So what happens to all those employees now that can't pay their own rent, right? So there's that cascading effect. And then you also end up building up just a giant number of renters, tenants who are not being evicted. Landlords typically know that, look, if it goes for several months and I'm not getting paid my rent, I'm probably never going to see that money. And then later on, people complain, and you hear this from the people in Congress, oh my God, we're going to have a tidal wave of evictions. Well, no kidding, you're going to have a tidal wave of evictions. I mean, you basically set that process in motion. I mean, you know, I take your point. As I said before, I'm not a fan of these moratoria, but if you're going to do it, you got to find a way to pay the renters so that they can pay the landlords, and you can keep the rental market from imploding. Now, the problem there, I have zero sympathy for Congress. And I mean, it's part of the problem with this whole regulatory state that I'm complaining about and we're talking about, is Congress can always point the finger at somebody else. Now, in this case, they get to point the finger at, say, the CDC, and, you know, there's the spectacle of Elizabeth Warren, Charles Schumer, Representative Ocasio-Cortez on the steps of the Capitol protesting the CDC. And my response is, hey, aren't you the guys who with the power to pass law? I mean, why are you protesting an agency when this is on your shoulders? But to point the finger at the local governments, I also think is unfair. So this rental assistance program, billions of dollars that are supposed to get to renters and landlords to pay rent. Okay, great in theory, but now you ask yourself, it's going to be administered at the local level. You got tons of renters who want that money, and you have the giant potential problem of what happens if people just sweep in con men basically saying, hey, you know, I haven't been able to pay my rent either. Give me rental assistance, when in fact, they've never been renting at all. So now you have to impose some way to ensure that all of these people are on the up and up. And guess what? That takes a lot of time. That creates a backlog. So what's happening in the States is a giant log jam of trying to get this money out to the right people. And everybody's pointing the finger at everybody else, which I have to say was predictable from the beginning. It's one of the reasons you don't go down this road, or you just suck it up and say, we're going to waste a lot of money, but at least money will get out to the renters. Congress has not done any of those things, and they should have been planning ahead, and they just haven't. So this really is a debacle, and it's created confusion, really bad confusion at the local level with landlords, with tenants, with eviction courts, at the local level. So it's a mess.
We are speaking with Steve Simpson, senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We've got a couple calls on the line already, so stay patient. We're going to get to you on the other side of this break. Steve Simpson and I will return. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Your daily dose of faith, hope, and charity. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're talking about the eviction moratorium extension, or if you prefer, the new eviction moratorium that was imposed by the CDC. The White House is trying to argue that they're not actually defying the Supreme Court because this is a different moratorium. And we're talking with Steve Simpson of Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. And before we get to Vicki in Minneapolis, who's been waiting patiently on the line, Steve, I just want to address that particular point. This seems like a bit of a dodge here, but the White House and some members of Congress are saying, well, this is actually a different moratorium, so it isn't actually conflicting with what the Supreme Court wrote, even if what the Supreme Court wrote was a controlling opinion, which they also dispute. This is the same moratorium. It's narrow only in theory, I think, at this point.
Oh, yeah, that argument is nonsense, and that's my considered legal judgment. But, I mean, the bottom line is this. They invoke the same statutory and regulatory authority, and that's the key point, is that what Justice Kavanaugh said in his concurring opinion in that stay motion was they don't have the statutory authority. And that's, in fact, what the district court in the D.C. case held and what the Sixth Circuit held and what a lot of the other district courts have held, is you lack the statutory authority. If you're essentially doing the same moratorium, maybe slightly tweaked a little, okay, now it only applies to 90% of the country instead of 100% of the country, but relying on the same authority, that's a distinction without a difference. So that argument, I'm positive that they will lose that argument in court, and that's purely political cover in my view.
Exactly, and I think they know they're going to lose that argument in court, but they're betting, yeah, I think, on the fact that it's going to take several weeks to get this into court and to get a judgment on it, and in the meantime, they can keep going ahead with extending this intervention. Steve, hang on for just a second. Let's bring on Vicki in Minneapolis. Vicki, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I hope I can make this clear enough with what I'm trying
to
say.
Sure, of course.
With all that you've been talking about, it sounds like, they're saying that, or hoping maybe, that the landlords can't handle it, and so that the government has to step in and make us dependent on clearing it out. And it kind of smells like the Great Reset, or kind of, AKA kind of the socialism or communism. I'm not sure which one applies to that, but I just wanted to, that's kind of what I thought.
All right, Vicki, thank you very much for your call. I tend to go with Hanlon's razor, which is never assume malice where incompetence can fully explain the circumstances. I think I'm paraphrasing that, but that's pretty close to it, Steve. This is the type of thing that Congress likes to do. They do interventions without understanding the consequences. And while I think that the practical outcome of this, if it's allowed to continue long enough, is that they're going to end up demolishing a good part of the rental market. I think that the outcome of that happening isn't so much that you're going to have socialism and the government's going to run it, but that basically only the large corporations are going to be in that business any longer, and you're going to have a lot of small property holders that end up losing their shirts, and that I think is the real risk here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on that on all those points. One thing I would say though is I think that, you know, one of the things we've seen during the pandemic is that it's you can call it what you want, whether, you know, you think it's creeping socialism. I tend to think of it as it's creeping government doing way, way more than it should do, and people just acceding to the idea that it is government's job to protect us from any possible problems in life. And essentially, you know, more and more and more that leads to government, you know, making private decisions for people, running the economy. And that does lead to precisely what you said. It's concentration of more and more, at least economic power, in more, you know, larger and larger companies, because they're the only ones that can stay in business. But, you know, we should be mindful of that as the, you know, early 21st century has progressed. We are getting more and more government making more and more choices that should remain in private hands.
Well, I think we're also getting more and more consolidation. And this is something I think that both parties have really dropped the ball on. You're getting more and more consolidation, so more and more economic power is in fewer and fewer hands. And that's also a big problem. And this could end up accelerating that. By the way, I just want to I want to make sure I quote Hanlon's razor accurately. It is never a tribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. And I it's a rule to live by, believe me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's go to Mike in Minnesota. We got a lot of Minnesota calls today, my former state. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I was just concerned about, I hear a lot of people talking about the renters and the landlords who aren't getting paid, but isn't there going to be a shortage of housing with all of these new immigrants that are moved in? And won't that diminish the benefits that the people that were already receiving these benefits are getting?
Mike, thanks for that call. I'm not sure that that's the big issue here in terms of this intervention. I think that's a different issue. It's not that it's not an issue. It's just that it's a different issue. And I think that right here in Texas, where I'm at now, we're seeing some of that because they're moving illegal immigrants around and putting them in temporary housing, but that's usually hotel rooms, and while that soaks up a lot of money, it's not really the rental. It's not really impacting the rental market per se. Steve, I mean, I think what we're talking about are two different things in this case.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely on that one. I don't think this has anything to do with, you know, immigrant issues.
So, Steve, what Pacific Legal, I think the philosophy on this, and it's pretty close to my philosophy here, is that what we have here is the basic problem of agency governance, right? I mean, this is something that started a century ago, expert governance, agency governance, where Congress and the executive branch both cede some of their authority to unelected bureaucrats to make rule changes. And I think the CDC here, in this case, sort of gave us a reductio ad absurdum, or at least slightly ad absurdum, of this particular problem, which was once you set these agencies up with rulemaking power and broad authority in both a legislative and executive, aegis, you're going to end up with runaway bureaucracies that Congress simply won't have the political will to bring to heel. And I think that's what we're seeing right now with the CDC in this particular instance.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question in my mind about that. And yes, you know, Congress has ceded so much control, delegated basically lawmaking authority to administrative agencies, not just the CDC. Heck, that's probably the least of the problem on this issue. And you're right to say that the president also has, or the executive has. And so, you know, people talk about the administrative state or the regulatory state as a fourth branch of government. That's definitely true. I often try to point out that, you know, it's a fourth branch of government is actually worse or more powerful than any of the other branches, because it exercises in some cases all three powers, but certainly the power to make law and the power to enforce law. And then what you get is precisely what you said. Both of the primary political branches of government, the executive and the legislature and Congress, can then point the finger at the agencies, and they can complain about the agencies. So it's a phenomenon which a former law professor of mine by the name of David Schoenbrod identified as power without responsibility. The elected branches get to exercise all kinds of power, and then they get to put the responsibility for any alleged mistakes on the administrative state. And I mean, that's a horrible state of affairs, and we really need to roll that back. And part of what we're trying to do at Pacific Legal Foundation is do that by prompting the courts to enforce statutory limits, to enforce the separation of powers, so that we really have the Constitution and the rule of law that the founders gave us.
Indeed. And I would imagine that one of your, and we've only got like 10 seconds to respond to this. You probably can't wait to get to Wickard v. Filburn at some point, right? I mean, that's...
Eventually, absolutely. That's the target, but it's going to take a little bit of time to get.
I think so, too. Steve Simpson, thank you so much. From Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.